1 Kings chapter 4. So King Solomon ruled over all Israel, and these were his chief officials: Ahaziah, the son of Zadok the priest, Eliphoreth and Ahijah, sons of Shisha, secretaries, Jehoshaphat, son of Elihud, recorder, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, commander-in-chief, Zadok and Abithar, priests, Azariah, son of Nathan, in charge of the district officers, Zabud, the son of Nathan, a priest and personal advisor to the king, Ashiha, in charge of the palace, Adonai, son of Abida, in charge of forced labor. Solomon also had 12 district governors over all Israel, who supplied provisions for the king and the royal household. Each one had to provide supplies for 1 month in the year. These are their names: Ben-Hur in the hill country of Ephraim, Ben-Deker in Machaz, Shalabim, Beth-Shemesh, and Elon-Bethanah, Ben-Hezed in Arabath, Socha, and all the lands of Hepher were his. Ben-Abidad in Naphoth-Dor, he was married to Tabitha, daughter of Solomon. Baana, son of Eliud, in Tatcha and Megiddo, and in all of the Beth-Shan next to Zarephath, below Jezreel, from Beth-Shan to Abel-Meloth, across to Jokmim. Ben-Yeba in Ramoth-Gilead. The settlements of Jair, son of Manasseh, in Gilead were his, as well as the district of Argob in Bashan, and its 60 large walled cities with bronze gate bars. Ahinadab, son of Iddo, in Mahanim. Ahazah in Naphtali, he married Basmath, daughter of Solomon. Baana, son of Hushi, in Asher and in Eloth. Jehoshaphat, son of Paru, in Issachar. Shimi, son of Ilah, in Benjamin. Geba, son of Uri, in Gilead, the country of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the country of Og, king of Bashan. He was the only governor over that district. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subject all his life. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebuck, and choice fowl. For he ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, from Tifshah to Gaza, and had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. The district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for King Solomon and all who came to the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. They also brought to the proper place their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and the other horses. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight, and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East, greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any man, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Hermon and Calcol and Dardra, the sons of Mahol, and his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He also taught about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. One Kings chapter 5. When Hiram, king of Tyre, heard that Solomon had been anointed king to succeed his father David, he sent his envoys to Solomon because he had always been on friendly terms with David. Solomon sent back this message to Hiram. You know that because of the wars waged against my father David from all sides, he could not build a temple for the name of the Lord his God until the Lord put his enemies under his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side, and there is no adversary or disaster. I intend, therefore, to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord told my father David when he said, Your son, whom I will put on the throne in your place, will build the temple for my name. So give orders that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me. My men will work with yours, and I will pay you for your men's whatever wage you set. You know that we have no one so skilled in felling timber as the Sidonians. When Hiram heard Solomon's message, he was greatly pleased and said, Praise be to the Lord today, for he has given David a wise son to rule over this great nation. So Hiram sent word to Solomon, I have received the message you sent me and will do all you want in providing the cedar and pine logs. My men will haul them down from Lebanon to the sea, and I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you specify. There I will separate them, and you can take them away. And you are to grant my wish by providing food for my royal household. In this way, Hiram kept Solomon supplied with all the cedar and pine logs he wanted. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household, in addition to 20,000 baths of pressed olive oil. Solomon continued to do this for Hiram year after year. The Lord gave Solomon wisdom, just as he had promised him. There were peaceful relations between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty. King Solomon conscripted laborers from all Israel, 30,000 men. He sent them off to Lebanon in shifts, 10,000 a month. So they spent 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adronihim was in charge of the forced labor. Solomon has 70,000 carriers and 80,000 stonecutters in the hills, as well as 3,300 foremen who supervised the project and directed the workmen. At the king's command, they removed from the quarry large blocks of quality stone to provide a foundation of dressed stones for the temple. The craftsmen of Solomon and Hiram and the men of Gebal cut and prepared the timber and stone for the building of the temple.
I must be very honest. At first glance, 1 Kings 4 and 5 seemed very unlikely to fill us with wonder, love, and praise for God. It's a list of long dead officials, has details of administration and negotiation, of logs floating on rafts and cutting stones. It will either put us to sleep or maybe cause us to just skip over it. Don't. It's in our Bibles because God wanted it to be there. It's meant to be there because it's part of his word to us. It's there because he has a message for us. And God does have something to say to us in 1 Kings chapter 4 and 5. And if we struggle to see what the message is, then the problem is not with God or his word, but with us. And we need to work harder to hear what he has to say. God has spoken clearly and plainly. And we need to work hard so we can delight in him and obey him. A good tool for understanding any passage is to ask, why is it in the Bible? Why is it here? I must say that I asked this question a lot this last week of this passage. What is the point? Why is it here? Why did the author bother to write it? And why did God include it in his eternal word? And why should we bother to wrestle with it and understand it? Well, the simple answer is, it's there because God wanted it there. And we bother because God wanted it there. Because it's there, we read it and we study it. It's there like all other scripture. It's there for a divine reason and for a heavenly message. As we read in Romans 15, verse 4, it'll come up on the screen, so you don't need to turn there. It says this: "For everything that was written in the past, everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope." So what that means is that everything was written to teach us, the whole of the Old Testament, even this bit and others like it. If it's not obvious, it just means that we need to make more of an effort to understand it. And we need his help. And that's why we asked God earlier for his help as we prayed. You see, this is an exciting passage. It should encourage those of us that are already trusting and obeying in King Jesus to persevere in the light of his kingdom that lays ahead of us. And those that don't yet trust in Jesus, I hope you grasp what you're missing out on, and that you'll be drawn to Jesus and to his kingdom. You see, 1 Kings was written to Israel while they were in Babylonian exile. And chapter 4 and 5 looks back to the good old days of Solomon's rule. It was a good time for Israel, and we'll see that the fulfillment of God's promises to Abraham all come true. God promised Abraham a land, a nation, and blessing. It shows what they've lost, but it also gives them a glimpse of what they can look forward to. And while Israel's present in Babylonian captivity can't compete with their past, the glorious past can't ever compete with the future kingdom that lies ahead. You see, looking ahead to that future kingdom and having a glimpse of it here is what makes this passage so exciting. From cover to cover in the Bible, we have earthly glimpses of God's heavenly kingdom. God's heavenly kingdom can be described as God's people living in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. And our first glimpse is way back in the start of the Bible, in Genesis, before the fall, where God's people, Adam and Eve, lived in God's place, the Garden of Eden, under God's rule. And God described that situation, and you'll probably remember, as very good. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. No sin. God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. People at peace with God, with one another and creation. They were living in paradise. Genesis 1 and 2 and the Garden of Eden becomes a blueprint for what God's kingdom is going to be like. And God's plan is for his kingdom to look something like, but way better than the Garden of Eden. We know in Genesis 3 that God's people rebel against him. They rebel against his rule, and so God expels them from Eden. He removes them from his place, and he removes his blessing from them. He removes his presence from them. And things go from bad to worse as sin escalates in its severity and its frequency. But then in Genesis 12, God makes a promise to Abraham. He makes a promise to reverse the effects of the fall. It'll be good to turn there to Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. It's on page 10. Keep your place in Kings and turn back to page 10 to Genesis 12, verse 1. And as we read it, notice the themes of God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. At the time, Abraham was still known as Abram. Genesis 12, verse 1. "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the people on earth will be blessed through you.'" See, God's promise to Abraham is all about bringing the kingdom. It's all through the Old Testament, and in the New Testament, we get glimpses of this promise being fulfilled. First, Israel grows into a large nation, but they're slaves in Egypt with no land or blessing. Then God, through Moses, leads the large nation of Israel out of Egypt into the land he promised to Abraham. And so we have God's people in God's place, but the book of Judges shows us that the blessing aspect of the kingdom is still missing. God's people lived a life of rebellion and consequence. Judges ends with the words, "In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did as he saw fit." But then we come to the book of Ruth, which I suppose could be subtitled "The Search for Blessing." And in the end of Ruth, the last chapter, a blessing is found for Ruth's family through the birth of a baby boy. A baby boy whose descendants include King David and King Solomon, the king that will rule God's people, living in God's place and bringing God's blessing. And up until this point, Solomon's reign is the clearest glimpse at what God's heavenly kingdom is going to be like. 1 Kings 4 and 5 encourages God's people living in captivity by reminding them what it was like to live in God's earthly kingdom, and that a better kingdom lies ahead. Let's think for a moment about the good old days. We all love to reminisce, don't we, about the good old days. Happy recollections and thinking back to stories of the past. Maybe you were happier as a child with no responsibilities other than figuring out how to spend your summer days or your really, really hard-earned pocket money. Or maybe a time when people greeted each other in the street, or your neighbors actually spoke to you, or when a pound got you way more than a Mars bar, when a phone was a phone and you could fix your own car without having a degree in computer science. Maybe your good old days was your time at uni and meeting and dating your future husband or wife. Maybe when your adult children were toddlers, maybe at primary school, or when your children were still happy to hold your hand and give you a kiss in public, or you could touch your toes. For Israel in captivity, what we have here in 1 Kings 4 and 5 is looking back to the good old days, the height of God's earthly kingdom. In Israel's good old days, they had faithful leaders. In chapter 4, verse 1 to 6, we have a list of all the king's men, and we see that godly leadership brought blessing. The wise king doesn't rule alone, but he surrounds himself with good people. And we get a taste of Solomon's practical wisdom here, as we see continuity with his father's leadership team, as well as him bringing in some new blood. Zadok, Jehoshaphat, and Benaiah all had a place in King David's leadership team, and now have kept a place among Solomon's leadership. And Solomon adds some new blood and positions to his team. Solomon is keen to rule well, and he knows he needs help to do it. And these names are exciting because it shows that Solomon is off to a promising start. Zadok and Benaiah were instrumental in God's plan to establish Solomon on the throne. You see, these are good, godly guys, and it's reasonable to think that the new guys were just the same. They must have been good, godly guys as well. And we see that the kingdom is in the good hands of its wise king and his leadership for now. You see, blessing in the kingdom is reliance on good leadership. The same is true today of today's glimpse of God's kingdom, the church. See, as we gather as God's people together, we are a glimpse of what the kingdom is going to be like. We also need good, godly leaderships. You see, the church is an earthly picture of what heaven will be like one day. The church needs good, godly leadership. It's what Paul says in his letters to Timothy and to Titus. And so church leadership matters. We can't just have anyone lead the church. So we must pray for our church leaders often, and we must hold them accountable. But we must also love them and thank God for them. All of our church leaders, not only, but especially our elders and our deacons, work very hard to faithfully serve and lead our church. Next, in verses 7 to 19, we see that God's kingdom was vast. We see that God's people are living in God's place. And so Solomon divides the land into districts to provide tax and revenue. And we see all Israel is unified as a result of Solomon's wisdom. God's people are living in God's place. But notice that it's a big piece of land. God in his goodness has given a massive kingdom to his people. It stretched all the way from Egypt and the Red Sea in the south, all the way up the Mediterranean east coast. And in these verses, we see evidence of good administration, attention to detail, and the accountability necessary for God's kingdom to flourish. See, Solomon is looking after the promised land and using its resources wisely. And as he does, the kingdom flourishes. Verses 20 to 34 show just how much the kingdom flourished and that God fulfilled all his promises. I'm going to read a few verses, and as I do, listen out for the language that we read earlier in Genesis 12. Listen out for the language of God's promises to Abraham. God's people, in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. And also notice the excitement in the language. So chapter 4, verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. God promised Abraham that his descendants would be as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Here the promise is fulfilled. They are as numerous as the sand on the seashore, and they are blessed with a good, happy life. They do have everything they need. They don't need to worry about anything. Everything is provided for them. They are in the land flowing with milk and honey. They have their plate in one hand and a cup of drink in the other hand. And we're told they were happy. Verse 21. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, that's the Euphrates, to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. God promised Abraham a place, and they're in it. They're in the promised land. Verse 25, during Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. Do you see how blessed they are? Each family is owning their own property in God's kingdom. Owning property is a privilege, and yet each man, every single family had their own property with their own fruit trees. They were able to go to their own fruit trees and enjoy its fruit. And they all lived in safety. Imagine living without the fear of threat. Imagine not feeling vulnerable as you walk the streets at night. Now this may not be such a big deal for us living in the UK, because most of us are safe most of the time. But let me tell you, coming from South Africa and knowing crime and knowing people that have been seriously affected by crime, these words are hugely encouraging. To be safe. But even here in the UK, we need to be careful. Can you imagine how attractive this verse is for our brothers and sisters living in war-torn countries? Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan or Yemen, or those caught up in the Mexican drug wars. 172,000 people were killed in these countries in the last 2 years alone. You see, it's the search for safety that makes refugees willing to take such huge risks to leave their home countries. You see, we'd do anything to keep our family safe, wouldn't we? In God's kingdom, God's people will be safe. We must pray and long with our brothers and sisters who are struggling. We must pray and long with them for God's kingdom to come. Verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the east, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. Do you see how Solomon's wisdom is equal to the task? A people as measureless as the sand on the seashore needs a king ruling it with wisdom as measureless as the sand on the seashore. And Solomon didn't just have a narrow wisdom, but he had lots of wisdom in a breadth of areas. He is far wiser than any contemporaries from any of the hot spots of the time. I knew a fireman who taught other firemen about fire safety. But one day he got really badly burnt and ended up in hospital for a long time. And you know what he did? He threw petrol on a live barbecue fire. It amazes me how sometimes experts in one field can be so stupid in another. Or how someone with an extensive book knowledge can be so useless at applying it to ordinary life. You see, not Solomon. Solomon had a breadth of wisdom, and he had a deep, extensive knowledge, fit to rule God's people. Verse 34, men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. You see, God's king rules wisely, and the nations are drawn to him and to his kingdom. Chapter 5 explores this further. You see, everyone wants a piece of the blessing that comes from being part of God's kingdom. See, nobody likes to miss out, do they? It's why you can't give one child a sweet around other children. And I don't suggest you try it, because as soon as you give the one, what's going to happen? They're all going to gather around your ankles with their hands held out, expecting a sweet. And if you don't have any left, well, it's not going to end well. There's going to be tears in their eyes, and you'd probably deserve a kick on the shins. You see, that's what's going on in chapter 5. Solomon is holding the sweet of blessing, and the nations are gathering around his ankles with their hands held out, hoping for a piece of that blessing. See, don't you wish that we had good, reliable, able politicians who you knew would never let you down and were always doing what is best for the nation rather than furthering their own career? That's what we've got in God's heavenly kingdom. It's what we saw in God's earthly kingdom with Solomon as its ruler. See, we need to see just how good things are here in God's kingdom. You see, this description is here to make us long for this kingdom, to be dissatisfied with the things of this world and to look ahead to God's kingdom. We need to feel like we're missing out if we haven't got it. In chapter 5, Hiram is the example of the nations coming to Solomon. And we see that it's actually God's name that is praised, not Solomon. Everything that's been going on results in God's name being praised by God's king and the nations around them. In verse 3 to 6, we have Solomon's message to Hiram. And it's actually three verses of praising God and telling about all that God has done. And then there's a one-line request for some wood. See, Solomon wants to build a temple for the name of the Lord who defeated David's enemies, the Lord who has given Solomon rest. It's the Lord who deserves praise for all he has done. Hiram hears Solomon's message, and he himself responds by praising God. In verse 7, when Hiram heard Solomon's message, he was greatly pleased and said, "Praise be to the Lord today, for he has given David a wise son to rule over this great nation." You see, Solomon is wise, but Hiram knows that it is a gift from God. He knows that it's God, not Solomon, that deserves the praise. In the good old days of Israel, with Solomon ruling, we see God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. Godly leadership brought blessing. God's kingdom was vast. God fulfilled all his promises to Abraham, and God's name is praised. But we also see the future kingdom and its king. 560 years later, after John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee proclaiming the good news of God. And the good news is this: the time has come, he said. The kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. You see, when Jesus comes, the kingdom of God is near. It's near because Jesus brings the kingdom near. He is the king, and the kingdom follows him. We started by saying that through the biblical story, we see glimpses of God's heavenly kingdom on earth in Adam, Moses, Joshua, David, Solomon. And now the king, they all pointed to Jesus. You see, Jesus ruled his kingdom, Mark tells us in his gospel, while he was on earth, by showing his authority over nature, by calming the storm, by showing Jesus' authority over Satan, by casting out demons, and by showing Jesus' authority as he taught with wisdom. Jesus, as he cast out demons, healed the blind, and raised the dead, brought blessing. Jesus is God's king. The place of God's kingdom is fulfilled in the person of Jesus. Where Jesus is, the kingdom is. The kingdom follows Jesus. Jesus brings the kingdom, but the full realization of the kingdom is not here yet. But like Jesus said, it's near, but not quite here yet. Under Solomon, the glimpse of the kingdom was good. During Jesus' time on earth, the glimpse was even better. But when Jesus returns, it will be as it's meant to be, the best. And all these pictures of the kingdom will pale in comparison, because it will be as God has always intended it to be. In a moment, we're going to read from Revelation 21. It's on page 881 in the Blue Church Bibles. And I think many of us have heard this hundreds of times. But as I read it, I want us to consider how we see God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing God's blessing. Revelation 21, verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death." Down to verse 10. "And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God in all its brilliance, was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal." Down to verse 22. "I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, Nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Verse 27 is an invitation to the kingdom. Only those whose name is in the Lamb's Book of Life will be allowed to enter. That's not a closed gate. That's the way in. We need to make sure that our names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And you get your name in the Book of Life by loving and trusting Jesus, the King of God's kingdom. Don't be left out. Don't miss out. If you're unsure about whether or not you're in the Book of Life, or maybe you want to be, please make sure you do something about that. Maybe tonight, pray. Come and talk to me or another friend, or grab a free book by the front door on your way out. Don't be left out of the kingdom. You see, if you're on the kingdom's invitation list, the Lamb's Book of Life, then rejoice. Rejoice, because the mess of this world will soon be over and we'll be in God's heavenly kingdom, which will be like, but way better than Solomon's kingdom forever.